This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, the huge effort to hire those who have served this country, what local agencies are doing to help hire veterans, and why community gardens are good for your neighborhood, and why there are fewer today than a few years ago. Plus, some of the new plans to get you to have fun in downtown Fresno. But first, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the unemployment rate for veterans who served on active duty since 2001, those referred to as Gulf War II veterans, 12% are without a job. The unemployment rate for those between the ages of 18 to 24, extremely high, the number at 29%. 26% have a service-connected disability. Many companies and agencies say those numbers are too high and have made a huge commitment to help put veterans back to work. Here to discuss the issue with us is Jerry Siniff. He is the CEO of the International AGRA Center in Tulare, which has launched a job placement program, and Gaitha Malone with San Joaquin Valley Veterans, a nonprofit that is affiliated with WestCare and part of Kings County Veterans Employment Committee. Thank you both for joining us today.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, I'd like to begin with you, Mr. Siniff. The AGRA Center has launched a program called Ag Warriors. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Ag Warriors was a program that was conceived probably about 18 months or so ago with a discussion with a lot of our folks around here about what can we do. Our exhibitors out on the grounds during World Ag Expo, about 1,500 of those, are constantly coming to us and saying, you know, you need to help us find good people. That's really a need that they have. There's a lot of good kids with lots of degrees coming out of universities, but they really know nothing about agriculture, and they're having a hard time finding those. And then we, you know, talking about our returning veterans with some other groups, and those people are having hard times finding jobs. So we thought, does it make sense to link those two together with our database of 1,500 exhibitors out on the grounds and this database of returning veterans looking for opportunities in agriculture? And what better place than the International Agri Center to make that introduction, that connection? So that's kind of what we're doing. And we're partnering up with some of the universities. COS is one here in Visalia that we're talking to quite a bit about. If a returning veteran needs a little more education to get the kind of job that he or she needs, they would take over from there. We would turn those folks or those candidates over to Larry Dudo at COS, and he has a person on staff who can help administer the GI Bill, get them the kind of education they need, and then come back to us, and hopefully we'll have a database of people or industry people who are looking for good candidates, and we just kind of make that introduction.
So what you're saying is you understand that some of the people or some of the vets may need some additional training.
Correct.
And you're going to try to provide that.
Yes, and we, like I say, we're partnering with COS, with Cal Poly, Fresno State, Kings River College, quite a few of the Central California universities. And depending if it's a dairy degree that they need, you know, Cal Poly may be the best place to send those kids, or those kids, I call them kids, but they're returning veterans. But we'll let the educational folks kind of figure that out, where's the best place to send them, the best school to send them to. And maybe we might even have some funds available to help them with some housing and those kind of things as well, depending on how the program goes. But you know, but mostly we want to make the connections with industry and the returning veterans and for sustainable opportunities.
But, you know, what do you think vets would be suited for the jobs, for ag jobs?
Well, you know, I guess there's a program in New York administered through Syracuse University that takes returning veterans who are interested in the financial sector. And it's called Wall Street Warfighters, and they take those men and women who are interested in a career in the financial industry, and they do the same thing there. And that's kind of where we pattern ours after. So we ask the question, if there are returning veterans and you're interested in a career in agriculture, then Ag Warriors is where you need to go. And we have people in the military who are aware of our program, and they ask those kind of questions when they come back from their service and said, you know, what are you interested in? If you're interested in a career in agriculture, then we'll go send you to Ag Warriors. We'll make a contact there. If you want to go into financial industry, you can go to the finance, you can go to Wall Street Warfighters. I understand there's a program for the manufacturers. If you're interested in working in an assembly line, there might be a manufacturer's warrior kind of program.
It sounds like a great program. Gaitha, I want to bring you in, Gaitha Malone with the San Joaquin Valley Veterans. Now, you know, we have a lot of companies today saying that they want to hire veterans, and that's a very noble cause. These are folks who have fought and given up their lives in a way to fight for this country. But it's not that easy. I mean, they don't just come right back and go into a job.
No, they don't. And we live in a traditionally high unemployment area anyway, so it's very difficult. And a lot of them have problems when they come back, emotional problems or injuries that change what they're able to do. And so part of what we do at San Joaquin Valley Vets is we find those programs that can assist our people here in the Central Valley. We have two offices, one in Fresno and one in Hanford. We serve Kings, Tulare, Madera, and Merced counties for our programs. And what we try to do is we try to get our veterans, when they come in, hooked up with all those organizations out there that can give them some sort of assistance. A lot of times they do need retraining. And now there's that new program that starts in July 1st, the Veterans Retraining Assistance Program, which President Obama signed into effect not too long ago, which will help match them up with the jobs that are needed and the job skills that are needed in this valley.
And, you know, that is not so different than what we see in the regular job population. We hear a lot about one of the reasons why our unemployment rate is so high here in the Central Valley. It's really a mismatch when it comes to jobs, trying to match up people, the skills that they have with the jobs that that we are offering. So what you both are saying, these agencies, your agency at least, when it comes to the ag community, is aware of that, and you understand that there will need to be some additional training. Mr. Sniffett?
Yes. Well, some of the industry contacts that we have, they really just want, you know, if a returning vet drove a truck in the military, you know, the military has spent millions and millions of dollars training these men and women. They really don't need any more additional training if they're looking for a truck driver. And we, you know, some of the challenges are, we've heard horror stories of medics coming back from the military who have seen things that none of us ever want to imagine we want to see. And this one candidate came back and wanted to get a job at a fire department with an ambulance service, and they said, "Well, you don't have the right credential," which is beyond belief. But you know, we would help them get that credential.
You know, and I think that's part of probably what's important. I've gone to a couple of, you know, job fairs for veterans and just talked to some of the veterans. And a lot of them really are having a difficult time knowing where to go.
Right.
You know, there are lots of agencies out there that are saying we want to help, but they really don't know at this point how to access all that is out there for them, because there's a lot of people are talking about this issue. So what can we do to make that better?
One of the problems is the disconnect between when the veteran walks out the front gate for the last time for the military service and reintegrating back into the community. Unfortunately, there's no, you know, Google veterans, you know, thing, and this lovely list comes up of all the services that are available in your particular county. So the actual best thing for any veteran to do is to go to their state veterans employment or veterans department and go to their website and find the local veterans service representative in that county, or to go down to their unemployment office and ask for the veteran rep at the employment office. Those two people are very much hooked in across the United States to what veteran programs are available locally for that veteran.
And Mr. Sniffett, it sounds like you are very much aware of this problem, so you all are trying to take your approach in a different way to make sure that that issue is addressed?
And that's true. You know, we're interested in finding careers for veterans, whether they're in Tulare County, Fresno County. We made an introduction to a company in New York. If a candidate of a returning vet lives in New York, but he wants to know more about agriculture, and we have a contact in New York, one of our exhibitors on the grounds during World Ag Expo, we make that introduction. It doesn't really matter where it is. We have a list of job opportunities that are available. And we find a candidate who fits that criteria. If he lives in New York or he lives in Kansas or Nebraska, it doesn't really matter. We're just making those connections for those folks in agriculture. You know, a lot of the vets are returning with a lot of skills that some of our, like we talked earlier, a lot of them don't really need. All they need is a credential or just some job knowledge of how to do it. If it's even driving a tractor, driving a truck. Farm manager, but we even have folks coming back with MBAs wanting, ag business want an ag business degree, and we have companies looking for those kind of people. So we're all over the place, and we're from the top to the bottom, from all across the country, even globally.
Well, you know, one of the things that you're talking about is the skill set and are the skills. You know, I had a conversation with a veteran who. Is in the computer field, highly skilled, educated, but he really talked about what it was like for him when he came back, and he said you do have to make adjustments. Like he was a supervisor, and he said he had to get used to when he was working in the classroom as far as not yelling at students because he was so used to doing that. So when I talk about reentry, it's not so much the skills because a lot of them do have this huge skill set, but it really is just coming back and getting used to working within society again after they've been out on the front lines.
You know, we're finding that these returning veterans are the prize catch. You know, these men and women come back, they have a work ethic that we probably don't see around here. No is not an acceptable answer. They get the job done no matter what it takes. They know what it is to put a full day's worth of work in. They understand the chain of command. And, you know, we understand in the financial industry, the Wall Street warfighters, companies like J.P. Morgan Chase are actually asking for those returning veterans who are graduates of that financial program because they do have that work ethic and they understand what it takes to get the job done and, failure is not an option. So I think it's a real mindset that these kids come back with, which is a real prize for some employers.
One of the things too, I'd like to pose to both of you and give our listeners an opportunity to respond to, because this is something that has come up. We are in a region with a very high unemployment rate. We have a lot of people looking for work. And I've talked to those who are unemployed, and they feel like now they're going to have to be – they're already in competition. They feel like they're going to have to be in competition with the veterans now to try to find a job. To our listeners, do you think – how do you feel about that? Do you think do you support this whole effort and that priority being given? Because so many people understand the fact that these vets have had to serve two and three different tours and not been able to work. Or do you think there will be a conflict when you try to integrate and you have the veterans looking for a job and then you have all of the other people that we have out there looking for a job? We'd love to hear what you think about that. Give us a call at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989, or you can email us at talk@kvpr.org. And one of the questions I have is, do you think the local agencies that we have set up, like EDD, and do you think they are really kind of equipped to handle the influx of vets looking for work? Or do you think it's better done being done as far as what the AgriCenter is doing on a front like that, that they might be better equipped because they're more nimble and they can move things around?
I think that actually the best is the combination. Places like EDD with their veterans reps who are veterans themselves and are aware of what it's like to reintegrate, they can help the veteran. And that's why it's so important to communicate with everyone who is assisting veterans. It cannot all be done by one agency. A lot of the veterans coming back have issues that they have to settle before they can even enter into the workforce. Secondly, they're also coming back to their homes. So they aren't really competing for jobs with people they wouldn't have competed with anyway.
Okay.
If they had not gone into the military, they would have still been in Hanford or Parlier or Fresno or whatever, and they would have still been looking for a job. So it's not like you're getting an influx of people who are not homeboys.
Right.
You know, they are. They're coming home, and they're looking for a job in their home where their family support is.
And Mr. Sniffett, do you, you know, have any feelings about that one way or the other, that there might be competition at all? But you guys have already said, you mentioned to me earlier, that you've just had a problem filling some of the jobs that you had.
Right, and we do. You know, and I can only speak for our exhibitors who tell us they're looking for good people. You know, the caveat is that the men and women who are returning from the military, again, the military has spent millions and millions of dollars on training these men and women. You know, one example we heard was that, you know, a 23-year-old kid has responsibility for a $6 million aircraft at 23 years old. You know, that's the kind of training you don't really get in college.
No, you don't.
And, you know, they spend a lot of money on training those kids, and they have a whole different mindset when they come in when they come out. When they come out, they're ready to sit down and go to work. And I'm not saying that, you know, the people who are not going to the military don't have that as well, but you know, they kind of have that little extra edge when they're looking for that. But that's a real challenge. It seems that something we've talked about a lot is, boy, are we kind of pushing just the, you know, everybody else aside and opening up the door for veterans. And, you know, that's kind of the employer's responsibility. Here's a good candidate that has these skill set. But it's your call, Mr. Employer. It's not ours. We're just making an introduction for you. And, you know, may the best man win, I guess.
Yeah. You know, one of the other things I've heard from veterans and veterans organizations, they say one of their major problems when it comes to getting their guys, men and women, back to work is that they're still fighting stereotypes. You know, that there'll be a news story about, you know, somebody having a problem, a veteran, and that everybody thinks they all have, you know, post-traumatic stress, and that they have to fight those images as well. Is that something you've heard of, you've seen?
I have seen it a little. But it really depends upon the employer, and a lot of that is employer education, which is one of the things that EDD does do. And that's to let them know that not every veteran that gets out has even seen combat. The majority have not. A lot of them have been in support places where they were not in direct combat. Veterans are a slice of America. They're a microcosm of everything that's out there in the U.S., every race, culture, religion, whatever. And when they come back into society, they're just the same. They're veterans, but they're Americans first. They're veterans, but they're Hanfordites first. And to say that they're going to have a lot more problems, no. I think what you're getting, though, that employers are not used to is, like Mr. Sniffett was saying, they're getting 23-year-olds with a maturity level that is far beyond the average 23-year-old out there. Part of the problem, too, with veterans is they get all that training, but they're not civilian certified. You can be working on a jet aircraft and be able to tear down and rebuild an engine and nothing flat, but you get out here in Fresno and want to get a job, you don't have what they call an A&P license. And without that license, it doesn't matter how good you are, you can't practice.
That's right.
So what kind of efforts are in place then? And I know we heard a little bit from you, Mr. Sniff, on what you all were doing to make sure that they get the proper certification and if they need additional education. But outside of Mr. Sniff's program called Ag Warriors, what are some of the other agencies doing then to make sure if all they need is something where they need certification, do we have the education community coming together to say, you know, we will help?
There are a lot of programs in place. Unfortunately, sometimes, like I said, we go back to that disconnect where the veteran doesn't get the information. Even while they're in the service, if they log their hours, they can come out with those AMP license or that LVN certification or whatever, depending on what they do. But let's say that they get out and they haven't gotten those things. There's two programs out there, the Workforce Investment Act, which they can contact EDD, and their veteran rep will steer them towards that. That will help them get into a vocational training that will get them their certifications. Also, there are programs now, the new VRAP, which we just spoke about earlier, which is geared at giving veterans that additional 12 months of education if they don't have the GI Bill to go get those certifications that they need. The Cisco certs for, IT people, and the AMP licenses for mechanics, and for LVNs, all their certifications. The programs are out there. It's just getting the news out to the veterans where to go. Because I know when I came back after being activated from the reserves in 2001, I didn't know where to go. So it's...
And that's what I've heard, you know, a lot, is just not knowing
exactly
where to go. And with your program, Mr. Sinoff, what you've talked about is trying to put everything in one, build this data place and try to put everything at one place for everybody for your program.
That's right. And, you know, really the ACRA Center, this is a production of the International ACRA Center, and we produce a World Ag Expo, the largest agricultural exposition in the world. We have name recognition in the agricultural industry, and that's all we're doing. We will be just basically the clearinghouse for both industry and returning veterans. And we do need help with the Department of Defense. They're aware of what we're doing. They make that. We've had some folks help us who go to Afghanistan and Iraq and entertain the troops and said, whoever's interested in a career in agriculture when you get out, let me know. Here's where you go. So we need to rely on Department of Defense and the Army and the Navy and all of the agencies to help us with this program. And we're making those contacts and letting them know, hey, we're here. So you got somebody who's interested. We're even getting calls from men and women who are actually still in Afghanistan and saying, hey, my mom told me about this program I heard on, like your program, and we are having fundraising concerts to raise money to do some marketing and some media kind of things, so we get the word out. I think that's the problem, is that we do need to get the word out so people know about where to go, and that's kind of the way we're going with it.
Okay, you're right about that. That's the one obstacle I've heard. And so, Gaitha, if you could again, some of the agencies or places veterans can go or should be going where they can access the information that they need again.
Okay. The first place to go, no matter where you're going in the United States, is get on Google and Google Louisiana Department of Veteran Affairs. When you get there, you'll be able to find a representative in your area, the local veteran service officer, who will be able to tell you about what's available in your county. The second place to look is in the employment department in your state. Every single one of them across the state has a local veterans employment representative. And if you go in and say, I'm a veteran, I need to talk to the vet rep in the unemployment office, they will steer you to the right place. And that's the place to start.
Okay. Well, at least that's a start. I hope we helped with this discussion. And I think a lot of people truly appreciate the fact that so many companies and organizations are stepping up and saying, you know, we want to help our veterans come back and find a job and be with their family. So it's all of you have great programs. Thanks for coming in and sharing this information with us.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. Well, community gardens do more than just provide fresh produce for people in the neighborhoods where they are planted. Some say they can transform those neighborhoods. Here to talk more about community gardens is Tom Matot with Fresno Metro Ministry and Kyle Famulos-Smith, who is an expert on home gardening and also involved in the newest community garden launched in the Lowell community of Fresno. Thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I can remember not too long ago that it seemed that we were announcing the launch of a new community garden, you know, quite frequently. But it is my understanding that we have fewer today than we once did. What happened?
I think that a lot of gardens, when they go away, it's basically a lack of organization and infrastructure. They kind of will come and go depending on the activity of the gardeners themselves. And
you know, I think that that could be part of it. A lot of people, when you say community garden, they think, oh, that's easy to set up, but mm-hmm. it's not. But a lot goes into setting up a community garden.
A lot does, yeah.
Yeah, well, and a garden is something that you have to put time into every season, and if you know it could, you know, a community garden can only live for one season if you don't keep putting your work into it.
And you have to make that commitment to, mm-hmm. to be out there every day to help keep it going. But it's not just the garden, isn't it? When you, like, for instance, the newest community garden, Lowell Community, and I mm-hmm. guess that took some time to get up and going. But I mean, you have to have land, you have to have money, you have to have resources, you have to have all those things.
Yeah, well, we got that garden going. We've been working for the last few years with the Parks Department and the City of Fresno to use property that they have to get gardens put in. And so they've got the land, and this particular piece in the Lowell was a piece of it's Caltrans owned, and the city is leasing that. And it's right at the freeway, so there's really nothing that can go on it. So the garden's a perfect fit right there in that neighborhood.
Why is Metro Ministry, this is part of your mission, so committed to community gardens?
Well, we have some pretty unique issues here around food and hunger, food access, things like that. I believe it was the Food Research and Action Center just did a study, and we are considered the second most food insecure city in the country right now, and right here in the middle of the breadbasket.
I know that seems just so odd whenever you hear that, just like some other stats I came across. I mean, we know that we have a high poverty rate here, but also when you talked about that, I think they said like 36%. It even could be higher now. The families say they have trouble just putting mm-hmm. food on the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's an interesting, you know, we grow a lot of food here, but it is a fairly industrial model, and I'm not going to knock anybody for growing food. Farmers are amazing, but that economic model that they work under tends to ship that food away. And so if that economic model is not going to exist to actually get food to people locally, then it kind of leaves it up to us to grow it ourselves.
Yeah, and even the organic farmers find a stronger market for their product in the Bay Area. So you can go to a farmer's market in Oakland or San Francisco and talk to all the farmers, mm-hmm. and they're from Reedley, and they're from, you know, Madera and Fresno County, and, you know, it's pretty shocking.
I would think we'd have a robust market for, you know, farmers markets and organic fruits and vegetables here. Not the case, huh?
Well, it's the difference of, you know, being able to sell it for $5 a pound in San Francisco or Oakland and, you know, $2 a pound here. So it's, you know, economically it makes sense for them to, mm-hmm. to take it up there. So it's a struggle that we have to try to find ways that we can, as a community, get those organic products in, you know, on people's tables.
Here, locally. Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of really strong small-scale family farms that are growing things organically and get them into neighborhoods. But, you know, we grow a lot of almonds and a lot of A lot of grapes.
And one of the other things you talked about, not just providing food. I mean, for me, that's a basic, because we talk about so many neighborhoods here in Fresno, and there have been so many studies done about certain neighborhoods here in Fresno, and it was that way for a long time. I mean, you had neighborhoods where they didn't have a grocery store. I mean, where people couldn't go and just, you know, buy an apple or buy a head of lettuce or whatever. It just wasn't there. And so wasn't that part of the reason why community gardens were really looked at as an alternative and there was such a commitment or a huge commitment to putting them in?
Well, yeah. I mean, we can even go back as recent as the 1940s and during World War II, 40% of our vegetable supply was grown in Victory Gardens. And 40% of a nation's food supply out of vegetables is pretty intense. Mm-hmm. And so these gardens are a real true solution to this greater problem. And, you know, a lot of these neighborhoods have a lot of issues, but they're also very hungry neighborhoods. And hunger tends to create a lot more problems than just being hungry.
Oh, yeah. Well, we have – it's my understanding there are – three community gardens? No, I mean, there's more than that. There are three that you all work with.
Yeah, Fresno Metro has three community gardens that it works with. We're probably about 7 acres and about 200 gardeners in those three gardens. So that's 200 families that are growing food for themselves. And we probably estimate, I don't know, there might be 30 or 40 in Fresno. They're just a little bit hidden, and yeah. Folks don't tend to.
Well, those that you mentioned that you all support, they are providing produce to how many different families, you say?
Well, just the ones that we do. We have about 200 gardeners, and so and we have a lot of different.
What does that take? I mean, to get people committed to something like that, just like you said, that if you don't come out, don't work your garden every day, and you're not there to really make sure that it's growing and nourishing. How do you know, what does it take to have that kind of commitment from people?
I think once you have the fruits of the labor, that's a really strong driver. After you get past that first season and see what you can produce, and you taste it and taste how, you know, delicious it is, and that it was the fruits of your own labor, that keeps people coming back.
For sure.
And a lot of it is also more immigrant families that are used to growing their own food, so it's not as big of a leap for them to get involved with it. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of education that goes along with gardening, and Tom and I were talking before this about how, you know, we are in this breadbasket, but you can talk to somebody and they not know what, you know, a fruit or a vegetable plant looks like, or they don't know that orange tree in their backyard is safe to eat, and, you know, things like that, that there is an education process that comes along with it.
Mm. And we've got, you know, at our gardens, I think the reason why we've been able to be sustainable with them is we've really, you know, as Kyle was saying, that a lot of immigrant families, it's part of their tradition. It's what they do. So we've got a site with about 115 people on it. We have a waiting list, and it's never been empty. It took us 4 days with no outreach to fill it.
Wow.
It's on 4 acres. And so there are people who will do it and keep it going.
So what does it take to really start a community garden? Let's say even if, somebody wants to, you know, start a garden in there, they have some, you know, a big enough backyard, or maybe let's say – you have it's not like an organized community garden. It's not like one of the ones that you have or support with Metro Ministries. But let's just say if, you know, you have a couple of families and they decide, hey, you know, let's do that. Let's do this. What does that take?
I think it just takes the commitment and kind of some common understandings among each other about what work needs to be done, what's common work and what's work that you need to do yourself. And in Fresno, there's this paradigm where we are not very dense, so there's a lot of open space around everybody's house. So The thing that will drive more community gardens is having a denser neighborhood with, you know, apartments and things like that, where not everybody has access to a backyard and a front yard where they can plant their own garden, and you're kind of more driven to need to come together and find some common land. There's a community garden that's being started up in El Dorado Park with the El Dorado Park CDC that's more of a dense neighborhood with a lot of apartments where people are coming together and finding some little scraps of land where they can work together on growing food.
Yeah. And it really, I mean, if you were to get together with your neighbor and just put a garden in, I mean, I guess as simple as you could say, grab a shovel, you know, and a hose and some seeds, and you can do it. You know, you're right. The community gardens, though, out in the public, there's a little bit more of an aesthetic to that. It's viewed by the public.
But you just mentioned the one, you know, where they're trying to put one in El Dorado Park, and like you said, it's a real dense neighborhood. If they're successful with that, what can that mean to that neighborhood?
It can really be a bonding aspect where you're out there with your neighbors working together, and you look out for the garden for each other. You know, it can really be a common asset. There's also the negative side of things, which I wanted to mention. There's a community garden, and that term was kind of loosely used in the Tower District that was just cleaned out today. And there was a lot of neighborhood complaints about it because it wasn't necessarily a community garden. So it was kind of like a guerrilla garden where people were just kind of working on it, and it was didn't have a lot of organization, became kind of a hangout for, you know, street kids and, you know, illicit activity going on. So there's a delicate balance of making sure that the surrounding neighborhood is involved and invested in it, that it's not just a, you know, the kind of vision of one person going out there and planting some things and thinking that that's going to be sustainable.
And is that why when you get ready to start something, let's say with Metro Ministries, I mean, you have community meetings, you bring the people in and as a way to get them involved. It's not something that you just, you know, start and do.
Yeah, well, the word community is just as important as the word garden when it comes to these kinds of things. And if you don't have if the neighborhood doesn't want it, there's no point in putting it in there. You know, I tell people that these are not if you build it, they will come type situations. So you really have to have people that are going to want it there, that are willing to support it and participate in it. And that can be any number of ways. You don't actually have to have a plot or, you know, be one of the gardeners, but just helping to promote it and make sure that it can thrive, you know, is it changes a lot of things in a neighborhood, landscapes and everything. So,
and one of the newest ones. And why did it take so long for the one in the Lowell community? You know, Lowell has been an area or a neighborhood where, you know, the city has invested a lot as far as trying to empower the people and trying to turn that neighborhood around and trying to give it, you know, a different face. And so it seems to me that you would have the community support there. What were there other factors?
Well, the community support is definitely there. And that neighborhood is at least I see it as being a very strong neighborhood right now. It's got a lot of participation and everything going on. And money really is the big kick on this. And we had, you know, the city had the land, but there wasn't any money for the infrastructure to actually build the garden. And we ended up with a grant from PG&E, which allowed us to have the funds and then organize everything else volunteer-wise around that, because there were the funds to make the garden happen. So people really came out to chip in to help build it. And, you know, they're expensive sometimes to get going, but the return is immeasurable, and it's something where the actual community is caring for it.
Well, Kyle, you're involved in that project as well, aren't you?
Not nearly as much as Tom. I've helped out a little bit. I've consulted on a few different community gardens. There's kind of a, you know, you need to navigate through the city planning process to get you know, a conditional use permit to operate a community garden, and there's things about community gardens that need to be planned out the security aspects, the accessibility aspects. Mm-hmm. If you really want to make it for everybody, you need to think about wheelchairs and making raised beds available for people that might be disabled, getting water in there, and you know, just planning out all those aspects. So I've helped with a few different community gardens in that mm-hmm. aspect.
How big of a factor is getting the water in there?
Well, it's huge. I mean, you can't grow anything without water. So it's really about just getting the hookup to the main water system. And then once that happens, you just have to run the plumbing. And, of course, materials are expensive for that. So, you know, fundraising helps. Donations definitely help. It's just access to materials, really.
So when the community garden in Lowell, because it just you just broke ground, what, a couple of months ago? Or
we ended up – gosh, we've been working on it for almost 2 years, and some budgets fell flat. That's why that grant came in perfectly, and we were able to move forward. But the end of March, we got started, and we got it to a point where folks are now in plots and have been planting for the last couple of weeks, and we're putting a little orchard section in this week and having a work day.
How big is it going to be, and what will it be able to provide for that particular neighborhood?
The garden itself?
Yes.
The garden itself, it's 32 plots on about two-thirds of an acre, I'd say, mm-hmm. about that. And it's got some citrus trees on it. It's got a strip along a fence line that we're going to be putting peaches and avocados and apples and different fruits. Some berry bushes, things like that on there. And then it's got an interesting feature. There's a setback from the sidewalk. It's a 15-foot setback. And what we're going to do there is to help minimize theft, we will be putting what's, I guess, typically called a vandal's garden. I'm sure there's a better word for it. but instead of folks jumping the fence, if they're so hungry that they need to jump the fence to steal produce out of a garden, then we might as well really just grow it for them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are a lot of, you know, I mean, Kyle contributes plants to gardens because he gardens extensively at home, and different nurseries around here have been donating things. And so we'll just plant stuff that's simple to grow, and the community at large can just come by and take some tomatoes.
Do you think, other than also here in Fresno with our hunger issue that's been well documented, do you think at all the concern about food safety has resulted in more people wanting to grow their own?
I think so.
Yeah, there's some people that are conscious about that and what they put on their dinner table, and they want to know that it's safe. Know that it's organic, or you know, see the process and be comfortable with that, and have a more flavorful product as well. That and even more nutrient rich. That once you pick a vegetable, its nutrients start degrading immediately. So the faster you eat it, the more nutrients you're getting out of it. So you can pull something straight from the garden right off the tomato vine, and that's going to be really good for you. So a lot of people are concerned about that.
We just saw a thing happen up in Sacramento with a tomato processor. He finally just admitted the guilt of cooking the books and committing fraud, and was hiding the fact that there was mold in their tomato paste. And, so when we talk about food safety, we're talking about a huge industrial system that can't keep up with itself. It can't keep itself clean. And, you know, a lot of people think that a small-scale backyard operation is going to be a lot more dangerous. But, you know, when you're talking
about... Oh, really?
There really is those misconceptions that I started a garden on my sidewalk for a particular reason. If I wanted to be out there and, you know, kind of encountering people walking by, and there's people worried about, you know, how can you eat this when it's right by the sidewalk? Isn't there going to be like contaminants and things like that? And, you know, I wash my fruit and vegetables just like anybody else. Mm-hmm. And they don't have pesticide coatings and wax coatings and things like that you'll get from an industrial farm. One thing I wanted to make sure I mentioned was there's this really interesting thing that some people are doing down in Tulare that I think you can look at, not just producing that food, but looking at how food is wasted. There's a lot of fruit trees. You'll probably notice, you know, that oranges just falling off the tree and,
exactly,
you know, going bad, that nobody's harvesting those. So there's a woman and her husband in Tulare, Sarah Ramirez and David Terrell, that are going around and organizing fruit harvestings and just getting that wasted food and donating it to the people that are that help harvest it, as well as, you know, the residents that couldn't harvest it themselves. And then everything else goes to the food bank. They just started in January, I believe, and they've harvested 6 tons of
wow.
citrus just in the Tulare County area.
But, you know, that is I see that all the time, and you wonder, well, you know, there, can't we do something, you know, to kind of not waste this food? But it really has to do with just having somebody that's committed to doing that.
Yeah. And it could, that could also be a community building effort, that going to your neighbor, hey, I noticed your fruit's ripe. Do you want to, you need help picking it? Or, you know, we should do something. Is that too much for you to eat? We should donate it to the food bank. And that could be a really good community building effort.
It's just awareness, making mm-hmm. people more aware. And the fact that you get people to start thinking about that instead mm-hmm. of just saying, well, you know, I've got these fruit trees in the backyard and they're driving me crazy, and you just kind of let the, you know, you waste it. You know, a conscious effort to really think about, you know what, there are a lot of people in our community who could use this. And why waste it?
Yeah. And I think another misconception is what we think food really looks like. You know, a carrot comes out of the ground and it's not generally, you know, 10 inches long and perfectly straight. You know, it's going to be kind of funky looking, and oranges are
the same way with a lot of your fruits as well.
And a lot of fruits as well. So, you know, folks maybe will move into an older home and they'll have this fantastic tree in their backyard, and it just doesn't look like what they see in the store. And so they don't think it's a good tree, and they don't think the fruit is that good until they pick it and give it a shot. But, you know, all that food, it's a direct supply.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I, you know, our listeners out there, people, if you're, you know, those of you who are listening to us, and we've all been guilty of this. If you've got, you know, a fruit tree or something else growing, produce or vegetables, you know, in your yard, the next time you think about just throwing that away or not bothering to pick it, just think about how it really could help other people in our community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, think about it. I mean, I'm sure there are even people who would love to come and just harvest that for people so it doesn't go to waste.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And a lot of those things as well, you know, I mean, the churches give away food all the time. You know, the food bank will always take donations. And there are a lot of organizations that can get that food to people.
Right. It just takes an effort on our part to have that kind of commitment mm-hmm. to do that.
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely. I would like to mention as well, if anybody is interested in community gardens or how to start one or how to support them, they're always welcome to give me a call at Fresno Metro Ministry. It's 485-1416. And this Wednesday, that would be tomorrow, Whole Foods is giving us 5% of their daily sales to help support community gardens in
okay.
Fresno.
So, I'm glad you got that in.
Yeah.
Okay.
So everybody go.
Go to Whole Foods
yeah.
and buy some organic
really.
Vegetables.
And that will,
it's going to help somebody else.
That will help build gardens. Yeah,
yeah,
really
I think it's a great idea. I mean, and not only that, for those of us who are, you know, entertaining the idea of just building your own little garden, you have a resource here. You have people you can contact, and they're willing to help you.
Definitely.
Okay. Thank you both for coming in. Jerry Sinneth, I'm sorry, that's the wrong person. Tom Maddott, he's with Fresno Metro Ministries, and Kyle Familis-Smith from Urban, you're an urban gardening expert. Thank you both for spending some time with this. I appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Some big changes going or coming to downtown Fresno involving some of the events we've seen really grow in popularity over the years. Here to talk about the ever-changing downtown Fresno is Kate Borders of the Downtown Fresno Partnership.
Yes, you got it right.
And that's for me because it's formerly PBID, Partners of Downtown Fresno. Was there any reason why you all just changed up the name?
Well, you know, in the past, if I would do an interview like this, we would usually spend half the interview explaining what PBID stood for.
So you're right about that.
We thought it was in our best interest to make our name something that was a little bit clearer to the public. So Downtown Fresno Partnership is, you know, a better indication of what we do. So it was part of our rebranding process to have a name that makes sense.
Okay. And for those of you who may not know, you know, Kate is a little new to the community. You've been here now 8 or 9 months.
Yes, I moved here in the middle of September. So this will be my first summer.
Okay. Well, we're looking for, and it looks like this will be your first summer, but it looks like you are already getting downtown ready for some fun events. Yes. Let's talk about some of them. Starting with what's coming to Thursday night, or has it already started Thursday night?
Well, yeah, we did a Thursday night concert series this year just for the month of May to kind of test it out and see what it would be like. Free concerts on the Fulton Mall right in front of the Chuck Chansey Park entrance. And the thought was we wanted to show people that you don't need to go home. You know, just come on out, listen to free music, grab a beer, hang out with your friends, and potentially to make sure they're aware of the fact that they can go to the games right there and the entrance is on the mall.
And that was part of the thing people would always say, oh, gee, there's nothing to do after work. And this
right.
is what you were trying to do with this event,
mm-hmm.
I take it.
And we are thinking about doing it again maybe the month of September and, you know, avoiding those really hot summer months because people probably don't want to sit out in the sun in July and August.
Unfortunately not. Also, you have one of our favorite events at Suds in the City. You're changing the date with that.
We are. We're moving it to, you know, in the past that event had been really coming up this weekend. And so we're moving it to October. This year it's going to be on October 13th.
Okay, folks, so pay attention. A lot of you who are looking forward to Suds in the City this weekend, which is a holiday weekend coming up, you are moving the date. And why?
We wanted, first of all, we have, you know, from a staffing perspective, it's difficult to put two large events back to back. And we produce Cinco de Mayo as well. So I mean, you really want your staff to be strong. But that was just kind of a minor, you know, afterthought as well. But we wanted it to be in October, closer to Oktoberfest, and we wanted to have a chance to kind of really rebrand it. So the idea is if we move the date, move the location, and give people a different feel for the event, then hopefully we can change it up a bit.
Okay. Well, that's always good.
Yeah.
And the Farmers Market, that's going to be at a new location as well.
Yes, the Farmers Market has been produced by the EOC, and we're partnering with them and relocating it to Kern Street between M and N Streets. Now, M and N won't be closed, so if you, you know, visit downtown regularly, don't worry about those streets, you know, not being accessible because they will be. But the block, that's basically the block where Starbucks is, the convention center, that's where we're going to hold a Farmers Market starting next week, every Wednesday through the end of October. From 10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Now, I'm sure everything you're doing really is not only to get people to spend more time downtown, but to introduce people to downtown. And our buddy Mike Oss said that in one of his articles, he said that he always felt that if you really give people something unique to do and something they can't do anywhere else, they will come downtown. And we really did see that last year with the beach party that they had,
yes.
That Club One had. That that went over really well. Do you think they're going to do that again?
There are plans to do that again. I've heard it's going to be Labor Day weekend, so I don't want to spill too much of those beans. But yes, that's what I've heard, is that they're looking to do it again.
And there is a new event that's really exciting that's getting ready to launch. In downtown Fresno.
And, don't use the word launch.
Okay. Well, in a way, that's what they've got to do. Let's talk about Over the Edge, okay?
Yes. Over the Edge is, I think it's one of the most exciting things because it really can't happen anywhere else. It's a rappelling event, and we're going to be rappelling from the 15th floor of the Pacific Southwest building, otherwise known as the United Security Bank building. And this is going to be on June 16th. So participants need to raise money. It is a fundraiser. They have to raise money, and then they can have the opportunity to rappel from probably our most recognizable downtown Fresno building.
So for all of you who are adventurous, this is a great activity, and it's a fundraiser, like you said, so it's going for a really good cause.
Yes, the money is going to go to a seasonal ice rink this winter. that we would like to have in Mariposa Plaza. So the idea is produce one event to support another.
And even those of us who aren't so adventurous, you got a couple of our Fresno's famous who say they're going to do this, because yes. I really want to see that.
I've gotten a confirmation from Chief Dyer, and our Councilmember Baines has agreed to do it. And we're looking for other interested individuals. We've got a lot of participants who've signed up already.
Really?
We only have 80 spots. So if people are interested, they need to sign up, because we will probably sell out at the 80 spots. It's a small number, but this is a small niche of people that are interested in doing this. So there's definitely some kind of – there's a thrilling aspect to this event. And a lot of people have a fear of height, so that's something that they will have to overcome. But it is 100% safe. There are actually federal regulations around rappelling, and they're higher and more stringent than OSHA standards, so people don't have to worry about the safety if they can overcome their fear of heights.
And how much time do they have left before they can sign up?
Well, depending on when we sell spots, if we actually still have one, people could conceivably walk up that day and just pay the fee if they wanted to. And in other cities, that happens. They have walk-up participants. But I would encourage people to sign up sooner than later.
Okay. What do you see? Like I said, you've been in this position now for 8 months. And what do you see downtown? Where do you see downtown going? You're providing some great venues to get people down there. But if you had to look at, okay, this is still something big and that I've got to tackle, mm-hmm. that I want to get done – what would that be? I mean, we've seen a few changes on the Fulton Mall, uh-huh. but that's still in progress.
Yes. Well, really, I think, this conversation about events are almost like the icing. I mean, they're something that people like to talk about, and it's easy for them to kind of put a pin in that and say, okay, that's something that's happening downtown. But underneath all of that, there's a lot of other work going on. We're constantly recruiting businesses, trying to help the businesses that are there. We're doing a lot of work with the businesses to make sure that they're stable and that we can give them any assistance that they need. We are working on the future of the Fulton Mall, and, it's a controversial issue, but a lot of people are talking about what the Fulton Mall should look like in the future, and that has a big impact on what we're going to be able to do as a downtown.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we're doing a lot of other fixes right now. We're doing landscaping campaigns, branding campaigns. I don't know if people have heard about our ambassador program, but we are launching that within the next few weeks, early June. You will actually see walking concierges on the street that will be there to offer a friendly face, give you a brochure about what's happening, answer any of your questions about downtown, make downtown, start to kind of fight that perception that it's not safe, because it really is only a perception, but perception's one of our biggest enemies. So we have a lot of work on that front.
Yeah. You don't have to, and that's it, you don't have to sell the people who are already sold on downtown.
Right.
It's really trying to get other people to buy into, what downtown Fresno has to offer, and really just the whole effort and goal to make it a better place.
Exactly. And that's why, the hope is that we do an event like Over the Edge, and people come down and they see something, not only the event that they haven't seen before, but downtown starts to look different to them.
Okay. Let's hope so. And thanks a lot for coming in, Kate. We want to have you back from time to time just to keep us updated.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Downtown Fresno. And that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.